The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in today for Drew Mariani again, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We've got a great show already set up for you here today. I can't wait to get into this, especially with our first guest. Chad Pecknold wrote a terrific essay at Substack called Post-Liberal Order. This was actually a talk that he gave, talking about the Great Commission, go out and make disciples of all nations, and how that applies to the United States of America and how it applies to American Catholics. And I found this to be one of the most enlightening essays that I've read about the balance between what it means to be American, what it means to be Catholic, and which one comes first. And I think that this is something that we see in our public life. I think we see it a lot in our private life as well. And I think we all struggle with this. And this essay is a really great distillation of the question and the essential truth of that Great Commission. So let me introduce Dr. Chad Pecknold. He's an associate professor of systematic theology at the Catholic University of America, where he's also an expert on politics and theology. He is a contributor to the Substack site, say that five times fast, Post-Liberal Order. He recently gave the Cardinal Pio Laghi Lecture of the Pontifical College Josephinum in Columbus, Ohio. And I believe, Chad, this is where this essay came from, right?
Yeah, that's right, Ed. It's great to be with you. And this was the annual Cardinal Laghi Lecture at the Josephinum, which is a pontifical college in the heart of Ohio. And this lecture kind of grew out of my own frustration with the American Catholic mission to our country, that we actually, as Catholics, love our country, and we love our country very much, but sometimes we love our country even more than our faith, and we would prefer the ideals of the country to the ideals of a country converted to the Catholic faith. And this kind of was the beginning of my frustration and how I began thinking about this. How do we make, if Jesus calls us to make disciples of all nations, have we succeeded or failed to make America a disciple?
Right.
That's a basic question that I sort of proceeded from that. And I think, you know, throughout the lecture, I think the leitmotif is that we failed. The Catholics have failed to make America a Catholic country. And I think there's many Catholics who would say, we never wanted to make America a Catholic country. We don't think America should be a Catholic country. We don't think it's possible for America to be a Catholic country. These are all possible responses. But I sort of wanted to put that before a Catholic audience and make them uncomfortable.
Well, congratulations. You have succeeded, Chad. And we're going to make everybody uncomfortable for the next hour. I mean, there is a ton to unpack here. And so Chad has been very generous with his time. We're going to spend the entire hour on this essay and what this means. And I want to start off with what you write about the Americanist heresy. Because I had a much different understanding of this. And I think it's also a valid understanding of it. It's more of a functional heresy. Yeah. Which was, and actually where I read about this was in a really terrific book called The Sons of St. Patrick. I'm not sure if you've seen this, where it basically takes a look at the New York, archdiocese and the succession of cardinals that have come through that. And the Americanist heresy, as I understood it at the time, was, and I think it's how it's framed in Sons of St. Patrick, is a sort of a battle between the hierarchical Catholic Church and the Congregationalist impulses of Americans, right? And and who controls the parish? Is it the people who built the church, or is it is it the Vatican? Is it the church hierarchy? And I think today we would say, well, clearly, it's a Catholic Church; it's controlled by Rome. But this was a huge issue for decades.
It was, No,
in the 19th century.
It was, and it was even preceded that issue of who owns the churches. It went right back to who chooses the first bishop of the United States.
Right.
I don't know if you know this history. I can't remember if it's in that book or not. But this was a very, very large dispute in the early days of Catholics in America, as how would you choose a bishop? Now, there was an old custom of people, if you know your Catholic history, you know that like Bishop Ambrose was kind of elected bishop by popular acclaim. Now, the Pope in Rome then confirmed him bishop. So really, the Pope did confirm Ambrose as bishop in the 4th century. But there, in the United States, there was this appeal to, why don't we democratically elect our bishops? Because we're in a democratic country, and so we should democratically elect our bishops. And Rome was like, no, that's not how we choose bishops. And they tried to appeal back to the days of Ambrose, when there was popular applause on the idea that, well, you know, in America, we're going to be Catholics in an American way. And so you're absolutely right. There were these things on the ground, like who owns the churches, how did you elect bishops? But the broader systematic problem, I think Pope Leo identifies later in this letter on Americanism that he wrote in 1899. And so that comes a little bit later than all of that. And he, as you rightly say, is looking at something more structural, that Americanism has to do with things which are going on all around the world and not just in America.
And part of this, I mean, you know, the reason why I bring it up is because you can still see some of these same tensions, right? I mean, in parishes, who controls the parish? Is it the laity? Is it the priest? You know, and that sort of thing.
Right.
I mean, those are very typical tensions. That's also probably not limited to America, frankly. It's probably tension that exists in many other contexts, probably Western contexts especially. But you can still see echoes of that in daily life. And
well, you called it congregationalizing, which I think is a very good word for it, because that is what Leo was seeing all across. And his word for it was that he would see it as a localizing of something universal.
Right.
And he saw this in Fabronianism in Germany, Erastianism in England, Gallicanism in France, this idea that you could make the Catholic Church, you could reshape the Catholic Church according to local interests.
Well, we're kind of seeing a little bit of that in the debate over synodality too, right?
100%. I mean,
there's still some of that in terms of how we're still presenting, and that's still a tough question to answer.
Yeah, I mean, in synodality terms today, you get it around enculturation is usually the hot word, that the Catholic Church should be very enculturated, and that means it's going to be different in every place. But in 1899, Leo said, no, the Catholic faith is universal, and it has to retain its universal structure, and that means that when it's in a place, what it should be after is the conversion of that place, that whatever the local community is, the aim should not be for the church to be as much like that local community as possible, but for that local community to be transformed so that it is in perfect conformity with the Catholic Church. And that I talk about in the essay, in the talk, as a missiological strategy, that Leo was looking at all these factors and saying, actually, there's a missiological strategy that has got to be clarified here. We have to be clear about what our mission is. Is our mission to be enculturated, to be, you know, super Americans on American soil and super French on French soil? Or is our mission to make disciples of nations? Is our mission to actually make the nations conform to the pattern that Christ gave his church, or is it something else? And so I argue in the essay that Americanism is a missiological concern, that he's targeting a bad missiology.
We are speaking with Dr. Chad Pechnold, Assistant Professor of Systematic Theology at the Catholic University of America, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. And we are talking about this really excellent essay at Post-Liberal Order. And you can find the website, postliberalorder.substack.com. Relevant Radio and myself, we're tweeting out the link here today so that you can find this later. It's a lengthy read. I've passed this around to a few friends, and I've gotten kind of a universal response, which is that this really should be required reading of all Catholics. Now, I have to say that this is not a scientific survey. I passed it around to my friends. So,
yeah, right.
So I kind of expected that response. But yeah, it's gotten a really... a really enthusiastic response with the people that I've shared it with. And I think the reason why they see this is because you root this right from the beginning in the Great Commission, in the gospel, yeah. Right? This is, therefore go out and make disciples of all nations. And as you just got done saying, the word nation here is important. Yeah. It's not make disciples of all souls, which of course you want to do that as well. They're converting the world. But Jesus was very specific to say, make disciples of all nations. And that, to me, is a hearkening back to the overall, you know, God's overall plan of salvation, which was to set up a nation of priests, prophets, to have the nations of the world come to Jerusalem to get the word of God, to understand the law and to be converted. This is a reversal of that process, right? Jesus founds the church as a reversal of that process. The church is now going to go out into the world and convert the nations. And you are very specific about nations. Why do you think, and what import does that have, just generally, without even getting into American interests?
Yeah, I mean, I, as I say in the piece, I puzzled over this too, and I've long thought about this. You know, is this when it says when our Lord says go make disciples of all nations, is this just like, you know, it's just a nice poetic way of speaking? Does he really mean going, you know, what we really need to do is be like, you know, the Mormons and go door to door? But the more I've thought about it, the more I thought, well, that is actually how Catholics have always been until very recently. We've always gone to the nations. You know, Pope Gregory sent, you know, missionaries to England to convert England. You know, St. Patrick is sent to Ireland to convert Ireland. And the more I thought about that, and you know, famously, sometimes it fails. You know, the Jesuits are, you know, sent to China to convert China, and it doesn't work. But the missiological strategy is always that the church is a communal body, and that the church has a gospel, is entrusted with the gospel that's been delivered once for all by Jesus Christ to be communicated to whole communities, and that the salvation of many will come through that communication. And so that our faith is this communal faith, and therefore the mission is always a communal mission. And once I realized that, I realized, our Lord is exactly right, and the church has always understood that until we got confused by modern individualism, that our mission is always to whole communities, language groups, societies, and that our Lord knows this, that we're social animals, that we're political animals, and that the gospel is actually going to reach people precisely through their culture, through their language, through their customs.
And through their leadership, right?
And 100%. I mean, you know, I'm very mindful in the piece, you know, of how Christian missionaries, Catholic missionaries have always gone to the leaders. St. Patrick famously mainly preaching to the chieftains. You convert the chieftains and you convert the tribe.
Right.
That's a pretty efficient, I mean, if you think about that in terms of being attentive to cultures, if you really want to be attentive to cultures, be attentive to how they work, how they function, how people are formed, who makes decisions and who follows.
So, I mean, one can say, well, look, that's a strategy, right? It's simply a strategy. It's more efficient to go to the leadership than it is to go to all the different towns. And eventually you have to still go to all the different towns. You still have to have the missionary work that leads to all the different towns under that leadership. But there's a difference between a nation that is formed through the word of God, through the gospel, and a nation that's just formed through, you know, secular means or other, you know, other types of religious themes or basically through ethnicity, which is, you know,
right.
We forget that very often here in the United States because we're a conglomeration of many, many, many different peoples here. That most nations will identify themselves through ethnicity. The French are French, you know, the British are British, et cetera.
But we do think of ourselves as American. I mean, we love the hyphen, right? We're Filipino American,
right.
Or we're, you know, Latino American or, you know, Afro American. I mean, we love the hyphen precisely because we do think that it means something to be an American and that it does have a kind of unity and structure to it, even if it's not quite like what it means to be English or French, it does have a kind of identity and coherence to it. It is a community. And the point is that, yes, with all of our diversity, with all of our quote unquote pluralism, America likes to see itself as one, as unified. And I think the Catholic mission, historically anyways, the strategy has been go after that. Go after the unity of a people and say that you actually can't be one without the church.
Again, we're speaking with Dr. Chad Pecknold, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. So let's take a look at Pope Leo XIII and what he saw as the threat of Americanism, Fabronianism in Germany, Erastianism in England, as you write very clearly about these things. There was a provocation, I guess, to this, or yeah, provocation is probably the wrong word, but there was a reason why Pope Leo XIII started addressing this. And you talk about Isaac Hecker and his arguments about how to basically assimilate Catholicism into the American experience, right? The American identity. So rather than focusing on Catholicism, he was focusing on being an American while also being Catholic. And that's in response to, to be fair, and I think we should be fair on this particular point, that's in response to an awful lot of anti-Catholic sentiment that was in the country at that time.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, we're referring to Isaac Hecker, who was a Paulist father. The Paulist fathers very much saw their task as a missionary task. They're the Paulist missionary fathers, and they wanted to convert the country. And I think you rightly say one of the biggest obstacles they believed they were facing in terms of an obstacle to converting the country was all these misconceptions that American Protestants had about Catholics, that we worshiped Mary and that we believed in monarchy and not democracy, and, you know, that we followed everything that the Pope in Rome said. So,
yeah.
You know, the sense of the Paulist was we have to, in order to convert this country, we have to overcome these stereotypes to in a sense, remove the anti-Catholicism. But in attempting to remove the anti-Catholicism, what they really did, at least I think what Leo is concerned about Hecker as one example of a missiological strategy is that Hecker's strategy ends up trying to convert the country by convincing everyone that you're super American. And that is the strategy that he sees in many, many different instances. So Hecker is just one example to Leo, but he's his hook, as it were, in the 1899 letter. So Hecker is kind of forever associated with Americanism because he was this local hook. But I think Hecker is just, whether he gets Hecker right or wrong, it sort of doesn't matter. He's looking at this phenomenon of this tendency in the modern age, you know, just on the cusp of the 20th century, 1899. Next year, it's 20th century. So he's on the cusp, looking into the 20th century and seeing, actually, liberal Catholicism is on the rise. What does liberal Catholicism do? It inverts the proper relationship between the church and the world. It lets the world, it lets the nation set the standard, and the church takes a back seat and follows. And Leo's very, very concerned about that.
So to extend my fairness out a little bit more, Chad, yeah. I mean, how much does the fact that there were already, I mean, it was really already established Christian nation, right? I mean, very clearly, yeah. Episcopalian or other, or, you know, more congregationalist Christianity had already preceded in many places, not necessarily all places, but it had preceded the Catholics. And so if you're going to have a Catholic conversion, mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you're converting other Christian, you know, ecclesial communities to Catholicism. And that might be a little different than what we're talking about here. And the Hecker argument might have been that the way to do that is through the American experience, to sort of get over that, the idea that Catholics were not patriotic. I mean, not necessarily defending Hecker's argument here, but you can see how that develops in this particular context.
No, I can. I mean, I think in terms of the country, I mean, as you know, in the essay, I'm pretty interested in the idea that the pre-founding era is really a triumph for Catholics, especially due to the Spanish and French crowns, which have a very, very powerful influence on the pre-constitutional founding of America. It's true that by 1899, you know, you have kind of internal disputes between know-nothings and various strands of Protestants, and then this, you know, minority class of Catholics, whom Hecker believes that they're going to get converts on the basis of saying that Catholics are pro-liberal, pro-democratic patriots. Now, I don't really know what sort of strategy that is, if your object is to either convert know-nothings or Protestants, because both the Protestants and the know-nothings would be quite happy to be liberal Democrat patriots. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely. So like, absolutely.
So if the missionary strategy is to sort of say we have to share kind of national attributes in common, that's the premise of converting the country, I think you've already failed.
Right. You've already given up. You've already given up the prize. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And I think that's why Leo calls it a heresy.
Right.
Because it has a little bit of truth in it. Of course, you have to find some commonality with people you're talking to. But like every heresy, it distorts and it takes you away from the truth.
Chad Pecknold, we're going to come right back after the break. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Relevant Radio runs on horsepower, your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep your station running. Join in with thousands of other listeners who have given their unused vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 30 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. We're in the middle of a great conversation with Dr. Chad Pecknold. He's the Associate Professor of Systematic Theology at the Catholic University of America. He also is a contributor to the Substack site, Post-Liberal Order, postliberalorder.substack.com. We're talking about an essay that he wrote, which was from a talk that he gave at the Cardinal Pio Laghi Lecture of the Pontifical College Josephinum in Columbus, Ohio. And it's a fantastic essay. It's a very long and complicated and very rich essay on the question that is posed to, you know, Catholics around the world, but specific to the Catholic experience in America, is how do you make disciples of all nations without making a disciple of America as a Catholic nation, which we seem to be reluctant to do. There's a long history here, and Chad, you go through the long and really difficult history of Catholics in America trying to suss out how best to do this. And you talk about the different threads that are going on here. We've been talking about sort of the turn of the century, 1899, 1900, Pope Leo XIII, expressing his very deep concerns that Catholics in America are becoming too focused on American values and not enough on Catholic values, right down to the civil freedoms and rights that are granted to individuals, which we all, very much agree with. But I think in terms of the Catholic mission of conversion, might miss the point, right? And I think that was what Leo XIII was trying to tell Cardinal Gibbons in the passages that you highlight here.
Yeah, I mean, he's condemning Americanism, which on some level, he's condemning liberalism writ large.
Right.
I mean, and especially the idea of liberalism as liberty as license, that you just have the freedom to do whatever you choose. That's what Leo's big theme is. He constantly condemns that as Pelagianism, as this kind of, worshiping the choosing power. And he condemns, he condemns that sort of religious liberty. If religious liberty means religious indifference, choose whichever religion you want, he condemns that. If, freedom of conscience means you're just free to choose whatever you think is right, he condemns that. It has to be a well-formed conscience. If it's total freedom of press, meaning absolute free speech for whatever you want to claim, including porn, he's absolutely against that. He condemns that because for him, those are all species of liberalism. And he thinks that these are precisely what the church should correct. It should correct any sort of religious indifferentism. It should correct a kind of moral relativism. It should correct an absolute free speech ideology. And that the church should be active in transforming a country. And that's precisely what you see in the 20th century. In one way, Pope Leo in 1899, I think, is a very effective at kind of throwing a shot across the bow at this heresy called Americanism. And you see a lot of new Catholic action in the early 20th century. I talk in the piece about how the American Catholic Church is, if you go see a movie today, you might see a PG-13 or R. That rating system exists because Catholics made it exist. The Catholic Church got very involved in Hollywood's golden age. It ramped up a moral rating system for movies that was in concert with, obscenity laws, in seeking to be an active agent in transforming the country morally, as well as religiously. And it's very, very interesting to see 20th century Americanism in some ways get tamped down, but in other ways get ramped up. It gets Catholics on one level have extraordinary success in the 20th century. Everybody knows Fulton Sheen, the Catholic Hour. Here we are on Relevant Radio, great Catholic listeners all over the country, great listeners from all quarters. But I mean, wouldn't you kill to have ratings like Fault Machine had? I mean, Fault Machine had the whole country in his hand. Now that's extraordinary, right? Because Fault Machine was giving basically homilies to the whole country, Protestant, Catholic. There was a sense in which the first half of the 20th century was marked by extraordinary Catholic missionary endeavor to the country.
Well, and this, I mean, this, you're kind of leading into where I think we see Pope Leo XIII's concerns really develop into reality. I mean, during that golden age, right, you had Catholics that were helping to form maybe not leadership per se, but certainly policy, right? And not just policy in terms of, you know, legislation from Congress, although certainly they were involved in that. They still are to this day. The USCCB still is to this day. Mm-hmm. But cultural leadership, Hollywood definitely being probably the most significant of that. Cultural leadership, you had involvement in that on the basis of Catholicism, right? Not on the basis of...
I don't mention Al Smith in the piece, but I should have. Al Smith, you know, you get the first Catholic, you know, to run for president.
Right, as a major party nominee. Right.
Major party nominee. I mean, he didn't win the White House, but he had enormous. I mean, we still have the Al Smith dinner.
Right.
That was a generation of Catholics who. I mean, you could say they took Leo's marching orders and said, yeah, we're going to convert the country and we're going to use power. We're going to use culture. We're going to invade Hollywood. We're going to invade Washington. Right. And then you have Father John Ryan, some people call, you know, him Father John New Dealer Ryan. He was a priest who was, you know, helped author FDR's New Deal. Most Catholics at this time, I mean, it's hard for us to think about this because the Democratic Party is now so insane, but most Catholics were Democrats back then,
right.
Because Democrats believed in, you know, the worker, they believed in the American family, they believed in, you know, state support for the family and for the worker. And they saw Republicans as basically the, you know, servants of the merchant class. And so Catholics and, you know, Catholics aligned with Democrats for that reason. You know, that all shifted, rightfully so, given the moral collapse of the Democratic Party. But in the 30s, Catholics had at least some reasons to think they might be converting the country.
Yeah, right. And again, through cultural and, you know, political and, you know, legal leadership, you know, not even mentioning Dorothy Day and, you know,
right.
efforts in, you know, in the labor union movement to protect workers. You know, the union movement was a lot different back then than it is today. But still, I mean, that was part of that attempt to assert leadership. And then comes World War II.
Yeah.
And which becomes an existential fight for many countries, including the United States, against various forms of authoritarianism and tyranny. And in your essay, you said this kind of takes us back to, I don't want to necessarily be unfair, but the Hecker model, right? The super American model. And it produces Catholic leadership, which goes out of its way to be, and I want to be very charitable here because I think that this might be an uncharitable way of putting it, Catholic in name only, in some cases.
Right.
But basically whose Catholicism, let me put it this way, because that really is an unfair way of putting it. Let me put it this way, whose Catholicism was subsidiary to their political agendas, right?
I mean, I would put it back onto the thesis of the essay, which is that they shifted back to the wrong missiological strategy.
Right.
They shifted their idea back to the idea that you have to demonstrate that you're super American in order to convert the country.
Was that just because of World War II? I mean, was that really, I mean, was that, because I would think by that point in time, people would have gotten over the idea that Catholicism lends itself to, you know, monarchy and to, you know, absolute rule. But I wasn't alive during that period of time, so I'm not sure if that was the case. I mean, was that really a necessary shift in strategy, or was that more or less just a convenient way to move forward politically?
Well, I mean, as you say, I mean, the essay is complicated because the history is complicated. I mean, the authoritarianism in Europe, Hitler, Mussolini, made the whole idea of authority unpalatable in America. And I think that's where you begin to get, you know, a Catholic, the Catholic becomes allergic to authority, even allergic to Catholic authority, even allergic to authoritative moral teachings. And this is all matters in the run-up to Humanae Vitae, in which many Catholics want to disobey the church's teaching authority on contraception.
Right.
But this kind of allergy to authority, I think you can historically understand it. If authority and authoritarianism is now associated with gassing 6 million Jews, authority's got to be bad in all circumstances, right? So you get this extraordinary sociological bomb dropped, as it were, on a natural recognition that we need authority, that authority is important. Like, government is authority, the Pope's authority, all of these things, the Father's authority, all these things, authority matters. A bad case like Hitler does not, a bad use of authority does not invalidate good uses of authority. But I think it had this overwhelming sense that now we must always, as Catholics, prove our liberal bona fides. We must prove our democratic bona fides. We must prove that we're anti-authoritarian on every level. And I think that made many Catholics kind of at least adopt the veneer of Deweyan liberalism, of Rawlsian liberalism, of a defense of religious liberty that means religious indifferentism. I don't care what religion you practice, so long as you practice one. That has, and John F. Kennedy in the 60s coming up and saying, I'm not going to follow Rome, was a perfect kind of moment of, you know, showing, as you say, the kind of hecker sensibility that the mission will be to prove that you're super American first, and at best you're Catholic second, and that your Catholicism is really a private matter.
Yes, the privatization of Catholicism, right? What I would call the compartmentalization of Catholicism. And that is, I think, one of the big issues that we've got right now. We're going to need to take another break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about compartmentalized Catholicism and why that's not an issue for just, you know, for just leaders. But also, I think it's an individual problem. I think we all have a tendency. We tend to, just because we have a tendency to sin, we tend to compartmentalize that. We're also going to talk about a couple of names that you may never have heard of. It comes up, and it's a really great distillation of where we're at right now. A couple of names that you never heard of from the 1960s and how their debate is still forming our Catholic public identities, I think, to this day. And again, we're speaking with Dr. Chad Pecknold. I should also note that his Twitter handle is @ccpecknold, PECKNOLD, so you can follow him on Twitter. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. You'll get some real Catholic answers right here.
This hour is sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More information, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy. Coming up live.
It's 48 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, talking with Dr. Chad Pechnold about his terrific essay in postliberalorder.substack.com regarding Americanism, and as we were just discussing, the compartmentalization of Catholicism in public life, and I think to a significant extent in private life as well, Chad. I think that that's one of the errors into which we all sort of fall into, is the idea that you can be Catholic in the parish and somehow that doesn't inform your political life and in some cases your work life, et cetera, et cetera. That we are all supposed to compartmentalize that because that's part of what we see as being American first rather than Catholics first or Christians first.
Yeah, I mean, I think this isn't in the essay, but I think it's worth stating that goes right to the roots of our modern liberal world, which was a rejection of the Catholic world order from very early on. And so one of the tools of liberalism has actually been a kind of separationism to kind of separate our Catholic faith from the social and political and economic sexual realities. You know, liberals tend to think, and again, Leo's attacking liberal Catholics and liberalism in Catholicism. We tend to think as liberals, I'm not including myself as a liberal because I'm not one, but if I were a liberal, I would think naturally that I should separate my faith. I should keep it private. It's something personal. If I'm a liberal Catholic, I think that is right somehow, that the social and political sphere should be totally secular, and my Catholic faith is something private and personal. And that is just not the way most of Christendom, that most of Catholic history has not thought that way. That's a very modern liberal way of thinking, that compartmentalizing. So you're right. I think it's not just leaders who are afflicted by that, not just Kennedy getting up and saying, I'm not going to follow the Pope. I'm, you know, going to follow the dictates of my country above all. That's a very modern liberal way of thinking for all of us.
So let's talk about the mid-century contest, because I actually really enjoyed this part of the essay.
Okay.
I know we don't have a ton of time left. I'm sorry, you're about to say something, Chad?
No, I'm just saying that the part of the essay that is most in the weeds is the one that you like best, so I'm happy about that.
Well, I have been accused of being sort of a geek and a nerd at times. So, yes, it usually is the way it goes. But the mid-century contest, and what fascinated me about this is the fact that you were exactly correct in your opening of this, which is the fact that you probably know the name of John Courtney Murray, and I barely know it, and probably don't know the name Joseph Clifford Fenton. Gives the game away, but it's worth revisiting what their mid-century battle represents. This is, you know, Monsignor Joseph Clinton Fenton of Catholic University versus Georgetown's Father John Courtney Murray. And this really does sort of shape the American Catholic experience, I think, since that point in time. And I think you do a brilliant job of demonstrating that.
It does. I mean, it's almost like you could almost just say Georgetown versus Catholic University, right?
And, well, yes.
And same story. It's the story of how a rich account of the Catholic Church's self-understanding is going to be muted, and the more Americanist account of the Catholic vision is going to be highlighted and make the cover of Time magazine. You had, if people do know John Courtney Murray, they'll know that he was a public figure. He was a priest, a Jesuit priest. As I say, made the cover of Time magazine. And the reason why he made the cover of Time magazine is he actually argued against the traditional Catholic teaching about the relationship between the church and political communities. And the traditional Catholic teaching was, of course, that political communities have an obligation to worship God. And that political communities, just like the soul has an obligation to worship God, so do political communities that have an obligation to worship God. And moreover, they have an obligation to worship the true God. And so the Catholic position was always that the church's goal was to bring a country to explicit public ordination of faith. And that could take on different permutations in different countries, but that was the goal. It was to bring about countries to the Catholic faith, to the profession of faith in God. And John Courtney Murray said no to that. He actually didn't think that was morally right. He thought actually countries don't have a moral obligation to worship God. And so he had an argument with the church. He wanted to change the church's teachings, and he did it through a proxy. He was arguing with the prefect of the Holy Office, a man named Cardinal Ottaviani, but he was doing it through an American named, as you say, Monsignor Joseph Fenton. And Fenton was arguing the traditional position, which is that the American separation of church and state is an error. It's wrong. It can be tolerated until we get to a proper relationship to the church, but it's wrong, and we shouldn't say it's right. And so he had this careful distinction of saying, you know, we can, you know, be in America, but not of America on questions of separation of church and state. But John Courtney Murray made an attempt to change the church's teachings through Dignitatis Humanae of Vatican II. And he was sorely disappointed because in the first paragraph, the Council Fathers upheld the traditional model. Now, they went on to endorse or sounded like they were endorsing the American view of religious liberty. But as I say in the piece, it's complicated. And Murray did not feel that he got his way. He didn't feel that he had kind of upset the traditional teaching. And nevertheless, we tend to think that he did, and that Dignitatis Humanae means precisely the thing that Leo condemned in 1899, this religious indifferentism. It doesn't mean that, and it didn't mean that, and Murray knew that Dignitatis Humanae didn't mean that. And so there was this kind of conflict between these two theologians that I describe in the piece, but it's really a kind of set piece to show this went all the way deep into a theological conflict. We've talked about this at the level of the laity, this at the level of leadership, but this also was a theological conflict which was happening in the theological guild between two prominent theologians. And Murray won on one level. But I think what we see now is that Murray's Americanism has failed just as terribly as Isaac Hecker's Americanism failed. And what I kind of hope to show is that we need Fenton again to kind of get us the courage to want to make disciples of the nation, to give us the courage to say, okay, we live in this country that we love, and if we really love it, we should want to bring it in concord with the Catholic Church and not the other way around.
And as you say in the fifth section of this, Rethinking the Catholic Mission in America, which is, I believe, the final thing, this is your summation. You know, this leads to Murray's practical triumph. I guess we can call it a practical triumph of Americanism. Leads in some cases not to all of the things that happen after that, but certainly it contributes to a lot of the ills that befall the church, especially in terms of relativism, because what is compartmentalization but relativism, right? Compartmentalization is just another form of relativism, saying, well, you know, I'm Catholic and that's good enough for me, but it's, you know, of a piece of, you know, of everybody else's truth. And that, I mean, that's, I think that that's just absolutely an open gate to relativism. And I think that what you talk about in this section here is really the emergence of relativism as a concept in American Catholicism, which leads right to the very next issue, which is that, well, if you believe that, then all of a sudden the the duty to convert disappears.
Totally
and has largely disappeared. We got maybe a minute. I'm going to let you take the last minute.
Yeah, no, I mean, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, in the end, I mean, there's all sorts of things in which this kind of return, this kind of late return under Murray to Americanism it showed up in so many different areas in the liturgical life of the church, in the dogmatic and moral life of the church, in the sort of collapse of, you know, priestly, you know, purity in a culture that is sexually depraved. There was no sense of being able to stand up as something set apart, wanting to convert the country, the collapse of Catholic education in this country. But the telltale sign of Americanism is this feature that you just pointed to, which is that Catholics have been relativized and they don't believe in converting America at all. And I think that's what has to change. I think Catholics have to desire again to be involved in their country and to save it.
Well, Chad Pecknold, I could do this for another hour, but unfortunately our time is up. He's on Twitter at ccpecknold, P-E-C-K-N-O-L-D. It's postliberalorder.substack.com. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. The Chaplet is up next.